On this episode of the Fanboy Garage, we continue to unpack our thoughts on the past, present, and future of the DC film properties with DC Focus Part 2, Batman. There's a lot to discuss, so let's open the garage and start unpacking Episode 8. And welcome to the Fanboy Garage. I'm Chris Lasanti, joined by my co-host, Aaron Varola.
I'm Batman. No, I'm not.
So last week you compared yourself to a Sharpay, and now you're Batman.
I am Batman. Nice. I am Batman. On Saturdays.
So it's part two of our DC focus. Last time we did Superman, so now we're going to do Batman. And Batman... full disclosure here, Batman is my favorite superhero of all time, and the reason why I got into all of this madness is just because of my love of Batman.
Yeah, I love this guy too. I mean, you know, me and Superman, we go back, but as I went through my horrible teenage years with lots of anger, I started to really understand Batman a bit more. So I can't wait to talk about this guy, because there's been so many different iterations of the character, and some have been just out of this world good. So let's dig in. Let's unpack Batman.
Yeah, so my introduction to Batman was as a little kid. I would, in the morning, as I was getting ready to go to school, I would watch the Super Friends. And when I would come home from school, I would rush home from school, pretend to do my homework, and be ready for 4 o'clock when Batman, the reruns of Batman 66 would come on.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just like everything to me. Like the best part of my day was watching Batman at 4 o'clock. And so that was really my first Batman, which is not quite the version of Batman that most people think of now, right? The Dark Knight. That was the more, the campy sort of goofy take on Batman. You know, even in the Super Friends, it was, you know, clearly a more lighthearted take. And Batman is, I've always believed, the most versatile and adaptable superhero, because we've seen him successfully, for the most part, in many different versions, right? Because even the 66 Batman was a success. And, you know, obviously the darker versions have been successful. There have been multiple different takes on the character that have worked, which is not easy. You know, not every character can do that. I mean, we talked about Superman in the last episode, how when they try to go kind of dark and brooding with him, it just doesn't work, right? Because it's not befitting of the character. Batman, for whatever reason, it's obviously it's not the best when it's goofy and but it's worked. I mean, even in more recent times, like cartoons like Batman the Brave and the Bold. As much as I love Batman the Animated Series, which is one of my favorite things of anything ever, it's just perfect. Batman the Brave and the Bold was a kind of a lighthearted take, and that was even really good. So Batman can work for whatever reason, no matter what version you use, as long as you stay true to some element.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, no, I definitely agree. You know, both of us being in the New York metropolitan area, we were both tuning in at probably the same exact time for the same exact show. I also was watching, was a big fan of Super Friends, but I would watch the reruns of the 60s Batman while I was at my grandmother's house on a black and white TV. So I had, I didn't see any of those colors or anything like that up until I was catching other reruns of the show on Nick at Night. And I fell in love with the guy there because I just thought he was awesome. You know, it was the comic book jumping right off the pages and out of the screen with the whams and the pows and all that. And I loved him. You know, I loved him the moment I saw him. And then that love just was ratcheted up exponentially when we got the Tim Burton version in 89.
Yeah. So. Batman 89, just to put it into perspective, for people who weren't around or maybe weren't old enough to remember the phenomenon that was Batman 89. Oh, when I say that the world was Batman crazy, it was like nothing that I had seen at that point. And in some ways, like nothing I had ever seen. I still haven't seen. I mean, everything was Batman. I mean, stores that didn't even sell clothes were selling Batman t-shirts and, you know, baseball caps. I remember going to Philadelphia on a school trip right before Batman 89 was coming out. And like, I just remember there was a plaza there and all around it were these pop-up stands of just people selling Batman things, Batman t-shirts, Batman hats, Batman pennants. I mean, all kinds of stuff. I mean, everybody was wearing either the, you know, the classic logo Batman shirt or that Joker shirt with all the ha ha ha's on it, like with the famous shirt that they had. Those were the two shirts that were all over the place. I mean, everybody had one. Like, you'd go play, like, we'd go play, like, a pickup baseball game at the schoolyard, and, like, every other person either had the Batman shirt or the Joker shirt. It was absolutely insanity.
I definitely had the t-shirt. My brother and I both got matching t-shirts, which was, like, a pain in the butt, because only one of us could be Batman on a day. and, you know, last episode I was talking about that Superman figure, you know, where you squeeze his legs and his arms go up, and I had the Michael Keaton Batman figure. I mean, even before that, I had the Super Friends version as well, the blue and gray version. But I had that damn Batmobile and the Batwing. I had all of that stuff, man. Christmas was amazing.
Batman toys were just nothing better than Batman toys. It was everywhere, man.
Pins, book bags. I mean, freaking shoelaces. You name it. If they could put a logo on it, they did. Underwear, tampons, condoms, like... It was out there.
I remember even in class, like right in the middle of class, like we were trading Batman comics, you know, because like there were a couple of guys who had already been reading the comics at that point. And because Batman had become such a big thing, like everybody wanted to get their hands on Batman comic books. So people were trading them and selling them. I mean, it was Batmania. And that movie to me is... There are very few things that make me happier than like the opening 5 minutes of Batman 1989. I love the whole movie, but that theme, the Danny Elfman Batman theme.
Oh man.
It's the theme that I hear in my head anytime I think of Batman. I have Christmas ornaments that play that theme. To me, that's my favorite superhero theme of all time. And Shirley Walker did a great adaptation of it for Batman, the animated series. So it became even more endearing to me. Just the whole thing where, you know, the family going into the alley and, you know, getting robbed. And then, you know, that whole sequence where you first see Batman, I just love everything about it. It feels like it was ripped right out of an old school detective comic. Michael Keaton as Batman and Bruce Wayne was controversial. You know, that was the original, like everybody loses their mind, except there wasn't an internet and back then, but people were like losing their mind over that's terrible casting and how can you do it and why him? And it's going to be a comedy and it's, you know, Tim Burton. He wound up being great.
Yeah, it was perfect for it.
I love that costume. You know, I still love that Batman 89 costume. It's
a freaking belt, man. That belt, it was like so simple, but like the way that they made it seem like all of those gadgets and stuff were like just tucked behind his cape somewhere, like waiting to just shoot out around. Awesome, man. I love that movie.
That Gotham City is one of the great works of set design that you're ever going to see. That Gotham City is, man, it is just, it's beautiful. It's gothic. It's Dark Deco, and I love the look of Gotham City in Tim Burton's movie in 89 especially. The look is different in Batman Returns, and that's a whole different thing that we'll talk about in a bit, but
it's its own character.
Yes.
You know, it definitely feels like a city that's living and breathing, and there's always smoke and mist about and you know, you could just turn down the wrong corner and be put in a situation where you're going to be asking for Batman's help to come save your ass. I definitely, you know, and you're absolutely right. In those first 5 minutes where, you know, that family's trying to maneuver through the city and they're like, don't talk to him or don't talk to that person. And the hookers are trying to get to them and all that other stuff. It's just like, you certainly feel like there's a sense of danger and they're just trying to figure it out. And they get caught in a bad place in a bad time. Thankfully, there's Batman.
Yeah. And, you know, there's just a lot of, and again, that was another movie where, like, there's a lot of great, like, character actors and whatnot sprinkled throughout.
Dude, Jack Palance.
Yeah, and I mean, you got Billy Dee Williams, and of course, the guy who was not a character actor, who, talking about how Marlon Brando and Gene Hackman got top billing over Christopher Reeve in Superman the movie, well, Jack Nicholson, of course, gets top billing in that movie.
Yeah.
And they paid him a lot of money to be in the movie. And the movie is essentially a Joker origin story, despite being called Batman, which I know some people have a problem with. You know, they're like, oh, it's a Joker movie. It's the star of the movie is the Joker. Batman's it. I get what they were doing. You know, Tim Burton clearly has a fascination with sort of the freakish characters. And I think he thought that the origin of the Joker, which we hadn't seen, you know, on film, or his version of the origin of the Joker, was going to be a more fascinating story. And I read somewhere where he felt that that was going to be a one-off movie. Like, he didn't think it was going to lead to a franchise.
Right.
So, which is why he sort of condensed the Joker origin story into the Batman origin and made the Joker the person who killed Bruce Wayne's parents, was because he wanted it to sort of be a self-contained story that had a beginning, middle, and end that made sense and tied in, and you didn't have to see anything before or after it to work. That was a decision that I know a lot of people are not crazy about either, myself included, but I get it. I understand why they did it, and you know, I don't have too much of a problem with it.
Yeah, this is one of those situations where, you know, canon and continuity, it's okay to go out the window because it's just done with such reverence. I enjoyed the liberties that he took with sort of intertwining the two characters with one another, because it does, you know, despite how it ends, you know, with the Joker dying, sorry, spoiler, you know, you do get a sense that these two were destined to be on this path with one another for eternity. And yeah, I mean, there is, up until Heath Ledger's Joker, there was no other Joker. I mean, obviously there's Cesar Romero, but in terms of this timing, this sort of decade, it was Nicholson the whole time. There was nobody else that could have touched that role.
No, I mean, Nicholson's great. You know, he's very much, you know, hamming it up at times and chewing up a lot of scenery.
Yeah.
But that's what they paid him to do. You know, I mean, you pay Jack Nicholson all that money to be essentially the star of your movie. Mm-hmm. And what do you expect him to do? You know, give a low-key, subtle little performance? No, he's going to chew up. He's playing the Joker. Like you just said, you know, it shouldn't be something that gets lost. People's, in their minds, the Joker to a lot of people back then was Cesar Romero. So while he's not quite as hokey as Cesar Romero, and he didn't refuse to shave his mustache and make them paint over it, he is, you know, doing a very, you know, big version of the Joker, but it is a darker version, you know, even with all of the, you know, but it's the Joker. And you're right. I mean, Heath Ledger kind of defined the role in film, but Nicholson's performance was, you know, was great. It's not Ledger's, obviously. I know some people believe that Heath Ledger makes Jack Nicholson look like Cesar Romero in comparison, and I get that. But it's still a great performance, and at the time, I mean, people were flipping out over that performance.
Yeah. Yeah, no, me included. I was actually upset that they killed him off. Because I was like, damn. And then I always thought, oh, they'll bring him back. They'll bring him back. That's why the little laugh, the laughing bag is laughing. He gets the last laugh. He's still alive.
Yeah, and there were teases over the years that they would somehow, once they started making other movies, that they would have obviously never got to that point, because the franchise never got to that point. But yeah, Batman 89 is, you know, I still hold it up there. It's a movie that I watch at least 3 times a year.
It's good stuff, man.
Yeah, I just love it. I love the art direction. I love the sound. I love the music. And it's just, I love the costume, everything about it. I just fell in love with that movie. And to me, it's such a great Batman film. Then we get to Batman Returns.
This one gets mixed reviews,
it
right?
Does.
So some people love it. Some people don't like it at all.
Yeah, it's a polarizing movie. You know, Tim Burton didn't really want to make Batman Returns. When he agreed to do it, they basically said, okay, you know, you can make your movie. So he essentially made a Tim Burton movie that happened to have Batman in it and characters set in the Batman universe. Gotham City looks different. You know, the art direction is not quite the same. Right. The set design's not quite the same. He, again, chose to focus on his villains and on the more freakish elements. You know, the studio wanted the Penguin to be the villain, or one of the villains, because they believed that he was number two behind the Joker. And, of course, Burton decided to go the freak angle with the character, because, you know, really the Penguin's just a guy. And so he did what he did with Danny DeVito and made him like a monster. And, of course, Michelle Pfeiffer is Catwoman, who is great in the role. Yeah. But there's a lot of non-Batman like things in Batman Returns. When I first saw it, I loved it.
Yeah, same.
You know, I was like, "Oh, this is great!" And I loved like the Christmas vibe, and you know, I love Christopher Walken. But
Christopher Walken. Yeah.
I know you love Christopher Walken. But as I've gotten older, and the more I rewatch that movie, I find that it doesn't age that well. And I find that it's a movie that I get excited to put on every time it's on, and then after like 45 minutes, I wind up usually kind of getting distracted and going to something else.
Yeah, I mean, the best scenes are, you know, between Catwoman and Batman. And I do actually really, really like the transformation of Selina Kyle into Catwoman. It was disturbing, but I love watching Michelle Pfeiffer kind of lose herself in that and lose complete control and break her house, her apartment, tear her apartment apart. And this is, of course, after she gets thrown out of a window and then the cats resurrect her by biting off her fingertips. Damn, that made me never want to own a cat.
Yeah, it's dark stuff. That's
so,
you know,
creepy.
Yeah, that's Burton right there being Burton.
Seriously. But it was good. I dug it. And, you know, I like Superman 4. Like we talked last episode, I like it. There's a soft spot for Batman Returns. And I get what you're saying. There are a lot of like not Batman related stuff throwing some dynamite in the dude's pants and then firing him down a well, lighting some dude up on fire. I mean, there's a whole lot of crazy stuff that happens throughout the course of that movie that you're like, Batman doesn't do that. Batman would never. But interesting thing. So the folks over at Batman on Film, Bill Jett Ramey and Rick Hsu and some of their other podcast folks like Justin Kowalski and Ryan Haas, they did an interesting podcast where they kind of break down all of the Batman movies, and they were commenting once about the Penguin. And it's funny because in my mind, and I don't know if this was ever in anybody else's mind, because they were like, he's spitting up black goo, like he's a monster, blah blah blah. And I always thought that his Oswald's infatuation with Max Schreck was because of that power plant, and that the power plant essentially affected Cobblepot. And that's why he's deformed. And so and the reason why he's spitting up that black goo is because he's got some sort of radiation from the power plant.
Huh.
I don't know where I pull that up.
It's pretty good though. You know,
makes sense.
Yeah.
And that's why he's so hard pressed to get him, because he essentially ruined his life and stole something away from him, being his birthright as a Cobblepot.
You are such the continuity king that you are now adding continuity to movies didn't exist. You're just now you're putting your own continuity.
I swear, if Tim Burton were on Twitter, man, I would fire that off to him and be like, dude, what do you think? Is that real? Did you come up with that, or is it just me?
Yeah. You know, the thing too about Batman Returns is that Batman, I almost feel like, is in the movie because it's called Batman Returns and he had to be in it.
He had to be in the movie.
Yeah.
Otherwise, he would have been sitting at his desk waiting for those lights to shine in his face.
Yeah. I think if Burton had his, you know, full control and choice, it would have just been Penguin and Catwoman and Max Schreck doing whatever it was that they were doing.
Yeah. And the best cameo ever, which was Paul Rubens. And I forgot the actress's name, but she plays Simone from Pee-wee's Big Adventure, who play Oswald's parents.
Yeah, that's a great...
Freaking love it.
The whole opening, it really isn't until Selina Kyle turns into the Catwoman that, and even a little after that, that's where the movie kind of starts to fade for me. Those, that opening period, I actually enjoy a lot. You know, there's a nice gothic kind of fairy tale, dark fairy tale quality to it that I think works.
Nightmare Before Christmas vibe. And of course, this movie was made before that movie ever came out, or Edward Scissorhands. I mean, you really get to see Burton's style flourish in Returns, and it's something that we see present throughout the rest of his films and his filmography.
I mean, Batman Returns is a mixed bag for a lot of people, and I can definitely see why, of course, based on the box office numbers and the general reaction, why the studio decided that maybe they had let Tim Burton get a little carried away with his Tim Burton-ness, with when it comes to Batman anyway.
And then they bring on this other Joker.
Then they brought in Joel Schumacher, who was, you know, sort of a nondescript kind of studio director, and he does Batman Forever, which is another movie that I sort of have a love-hate relationship with, in that when I first saw it in the theaters, I enjoyed it, and then the more I watched it, I was like, man, you know what? I guess I was just young. There is so much wrong with Batman Forever. I actually don't mind Val Kilmer. I thought he was fine, actually. I thought he was pretty good, you know, considering that it wasn't going to be Michael Keaton. But the villains in that movie, to me, are a disaster. Tommy Lee Jones could not be any more wrong as Two-Face. Not the actor himself, but the portrayal of the character.
Yeah.
I mean, they turned him into the Joker. Now, I don't know if that's because Joel Schumacher or Tommy Lee Jones had never seen Two-Face or read Two-Face. They had no idea what the character was supposed to be, and they just assumed that he was like the Joker. But he's like laughing and being goofy, and he's obviously, they went with the vibrant colors.
Yeah.
They gave you no backstory. The relationship between Harvey Dent and Bruce Wayne is one of the great kind of stories in both the comics and also the episodes of Batman, the animated series, Two-Face and Two-Face Part 2 are two of the best episodes of superhero television ever made. It's such a great story, and they just glossed over it. Forget the fact that it's not even the same act. I mean, Billy Dee Williams was Harvey Dent, right? Prior. And now the person that essentially becomes, and they do call him Harvey at times in Batman Forever. It's supposed to be the same person, but now he's Tommy Lee Jones.
Yeah.
Needless to say, Tommy Lee Jones and Billy Dee Williams cannot be mistaken for one another. And so they just really just threw everything out the window.
That's a funny thing, right? So for folks that don't know this, Batman 89, Batman Returns, and Batman Forever, and Batman and Robin are supposed to be the same Batman.
Correct.
In the same Gotham City.
Yep.
Over and over again across those four films. And those four movies couldn't be more different from one another.
Yes.
And they do some really interesting stuff in Forever. I mean, I wanted to like it. I really did. Because it was at the height of Jim Carrey's career.
Right. I haven't even gotten to him yet.
Yeah, he.
He's also playing the Joker. He's playing the Cesar Romero Joker as the Riddler. He's not even playing the Frank Gorshin Riddler. He's playing, literally, he's doing Cesar Romero as the Joker, as the Riddler.
Yeah. The movie's a bit of a mess. And then let's talk about Robin, who's 4 years junior from Bruce Wayne. It's like, hey,
Robin's 36 years old in Batman Forever.
And he's like, what? Hey, are you going to stay with me, Bruce Wayne? It's like, shouldn't you be out with a job and your own apartment, dude? You don't need to be foster cared by Bruce Wayne. Like, what is that stuff?
I know. Man. It's really bizarre. And it defeats the whole, if you're going to tell that story, I mean, who, didn't anybody just pause for a second and say, wait a minute. This doesn't make sense. Like, I understand that we're casting this movie based on who's hot right now. So, yeah, obviously, Jim Carrey was hot. Tommy Lee Jones was hot, right? Coming off The Fugitive.
Yeah.
Chris O'Donnell was hot, coming off Scent of a Woman. Let's just throw logic out the window and just cast based on who we think is hot, like, right now as actors. And nobody ever stopped to say or raise their hand. I'm actually raising my hand right now. You can't see. And saying, hi, wait a minute. The whole reason why Bruce Wayne takes Dick Grayson in after his parents are murdered is because he's a child. And you're also drawing a parallel between Bruce Wayne, right, as the orphan child, and Dick Grayson as the orphan child.
Nah.
You can't tell that story if Robin is, you know, ready to collect Social Security.
You know, when his parents die. You know, he's got his ears pierced. He's like some badass rebel without a cause. Yeah, it's just a mess.
I mean, there was a way to tell that story if you wanted to, but not tell it with the true origin of Dick Grayson.
Yeah, it's just sloppily done. And then they decided, hey, if you guys haven't had enough, we're gonna double down on this, and we're gonna give you Batman and Robin with the one line king himself, Arnold Schwarzenegger playing Mr. Freeze. Uma Thurman playing Poison Ivy, which is just like freaking bizarre. And then we've got a very swollen Green Grape playing Bane.
So, okay. I was not expecting that. Yes. So the Green Grape is actually a pro wrestler by the name of Jeep Swenson, who I believe has passed away.
Actually a couple of years after after the movie.
And this is a more egregious case of getting your villains wrong. At this point, they were just like, hey, the more the merrier. We can't have enough characters because you can't sell enough action figures, right? So we have to have multiple suits. So I don't know. You're a big toy guy, I know. So, you know, even before this, you would always get these variations, right? Well,
oh my gosh, dude, where
you'd have this tactical, this and
the movies would roll out. I mean, at this point, right? Not to kind of go off on a side tangent, but at this point you had Batman the Animated Series, right? And that toy line, that had its own toy line, right? And the different kinds of tactical suits, underwater, camouflage Batman, space Batman, you know, glow-in-the-dark Batman, all those other crap. And then they just doubled down on it with, like, this is ice skating Batman. This is, you know, winter tundra Batman with his, like, you throw hot water on him and his suit changes colors and blah, blah, blah. So they had like three or four different lines or series of Batman toys that had different variations. So honestly, there was probably about 15 different SKUs on store shelves of like Batman figures, because they also at that time as well, they were running all the same Super Friends line that people had seen for many years, like the classic kind of edition. So yeah, they were definitely trying to make their merchandise dollars with all of these different kinds of toys, and that's why we got so many freaking suits in the movie.
Well, that's the thing though. Like prior, like the other movies and the animators of, like you said, they had these different versions in the toys, but not in the movies or the show. Yeah. Batman and Robin just said, "The hell with it." Every time you see Batman and Robin, they're going to have some new thing. They're going to have different suit, different, you know, like you said, ice skating Batman, this Batman, glow in the dark Batman. They're literally in the movie. They're not just a toy. The entire movie is like staring at a toy display in Toys R Us of all these different suits. And none of them, and they're all, one is hokier than the other. It's really just like the Batman 66 show, like modern version of it, but without the wink, wink. You know, like Batman 66 was winking at you. Like it wasn't taking itself seriously. Batman and Robin is taking itself seriously and just thinks that was the way it needed to be because Batman had gotten too dark.
So, oh, you mean when he pulls out his Batman credit card? It's not a nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Never leave home without it.
Yeah, no, that's just,
never leave the Batcave without it.
That's just bad. I mean, and talk about bad casting. So we talked about the whole, you know, Dick Grayson thing. I mean, I have no problem with Chris O'Donnell as an actor. I just thought that it was, the casting was off based on timelines. But Alicia Silverstone, who is not only mailing it in. Now, again, you pick up like the hot, right, actor.
Yeah, coming off of Clueless.
Coming off of Clueless. They put her in the movie. She looked like she wanted to be anywhere else but. And you go through the trouble. So they kept the Dick, they kept Robin as Dick Grayson, right? And despite the age difference and everything else, but they couldn't bother. They needed to actually change the origin of Batgirl. They kept her Barbara, but they made her Barbara Pennyworth, Alfred's niece, instead of Barbara Gordon, Commissioner Gordon's daughter, which is a very dramatic shift. And one of the other main reasons why I think they did it was because they never bothered to explore the relationship between Commissioner Gordon and Batman, which is essential to that. That's a core element, I think, to the Batman universe. So because of that, I think it would have been like, whatever, like who cares? But so they decided to make her Alfred's niece, and then they tie it in with that whole story where he's sick. And
I mean, Commissioner Gordon becomes a shell of himself by this movie. I mean, in Batman 89, you see the foundations of a relationship to some degree, because he's the one who reads the nice little note that Batman gives him.
Right.
By returns, they're having full-blown conversations with one another, right?
Yep.
About, oh, I think it's this gang, blah, blah, blah. And then by Forever, and then we're so, it's just like, he's just some, like, background character that chimes in with another hokey line or whatever like that. It's just,
Gaga. So Barbara Pennyworth,
yeah,
man, it's just so bad. And Bane is
swollen, you know, grape,
you have
man.
To understand, Bane at this point is somewhat iconic in
Dude,
that
he breaks
night,
Batman's
yeah,
back.
Yeah, the Nightfall storyline had happened already. And you would think that that's why you have Bane in this movie, right? I mean, Bane wasn't in the 66 show, right? He wasn't around. So, like, that's, you would think that's where they find out about Bane, and they put him in the movie and make him a sidekick, like, muscle man for Poison Ivy. He's a bouncer, basically.
And all he says is,
Bane. Right, and Bane is supposed to be very intelligent and well-spoken.
Yeah,
and it's, God, it's, they got all of that wrong. Uma Thurman is Poison Ivy. I mean, she looks like she's in a Broadway show. Like, she speaks and moves around like she's in Chicago instead of a Batman movie.
So right. Yeah. Oh, my God.
And Schwarzenegger, I mean, you know, that's just bad casting. I understand that's, he's Arnold Schwarzenegger. I know you want the name. Couldn't have been any more wrong for that role. The one-liners are horrendous. Now, the amazing thing, too, about it is they were so close, right? They did take the story of the Heart of Ice story from Batman, the Animated Series, which reinvented Mr. Freeze, right? Mr. Freeze before Heart of Ice was just like a whatever character. He was a mad scientist with a freeze gun. Heart of Ice gives him a backstory, and it's a great one. It's an amazing episode of television where his wife has a terminal illness, and he's keeping her frozen until he could find a cure for the disease. And obviously things go wrong. She winds up dying. He winds up, you know, becoming Mr. Freeze. And it's a tragic story, and it's a great story, and it's a great villain. They took that element of his backstory, and they brought it into Batman and Robin, and then just did nothing with it. They actually wound up applying it, having Alfred be more involved in that element of it.
McGregor's syndrome.
Yeah. And it winds up being like a throwaway thing for Mr. Freeze, but a key component of the Alfred story arc with his niece, and how she comes to discover that they are, in fact, Batman and Robin, is one of the worst scenes in superhero movie history.
Oh, my God.
I referenced it in, I talk about it like when we see BVS, where when they discover the Justice League, you know, the other characters. I said that was sort of like Barbara Gordoning it in Barbara Pennyworthing it in Batman and Robin, because she just magically figures out this password that Alfred has, and he magically, by the way, he expects her to do it. So he has everything ready for her.
Because he recorded a virtual message.
Yeah, because who doesn't create a password just to make someone, you know, waste their time trying to figure it out, because you know they're going to figure it out already.
Right, right.
Because that makes sense on every level.
And where, I mean, honestly,
why not just tell her at that point?
And so these alarms are going off and they're like, intruder alert. And like, where are Batman and Robin? Like, don't they have beepers? I know it's the 90s, so maybe they had cell phones. Well, no, he had a cell phone. He's freaking rich. At what point is something not patched in? Like, hey, and then he makes a joke of it. Bruce Wayne goes, yeah, maybe we got to change the locks here.
Yeah, and, you know, obviously, I know you're a big fan of Clooney as Batman.
Oh, yeah, dude. Me and Clooney, love him. Yeah. Love him. Yeah. Stands right up there next to Affleck from Justice League.
Yeah.
Wait for that one.
We haven't even talked about, but you know what? It doesn't even matter. It wouldn't have mattered who Batman was in Batman and Robin.
It was so freaking bad.
It's just a disaster.
And you know what it did? It killed the franchise.
It sure did.
Killed it.
And thankfully we have other things to talk about, because they did decide to revive the Batman franchise in film. And they handed the reins over to Christopher Nolan, who is not a director that you would necessarily expect to be making a superhero film. And Christopher Nolan makes Batman Begins, which is a great film. And to me is a movie that I think gets better with age.
Hell yeah.
I actually, the more I watch Batman Begins, I actually start to like it even more than The Dark Knight. And that's not a knock on The Dark Knight. I love The Dark Knight. Contrary to what a lot of people think, Batman Begins is such a Batman movie. There are scenes in Batman Begins that are ripped right out of panels of classic comic books, like Batman Year One and Batman The Long Halloween, two of my favorite Batman stories ever. It's a great movie. It's a great take on the character. I mean, we mentioned in the last episode that he said he used Richard Donner's Superman as sort of an inspiration for how he set the story and how he cast the movie. You know, like, he has Michael Caine as Alfred. You know, he has Morgan Freeman as Lucius Fox. Rutger Hauer is in this, and, you know, doesn't have a huge role in the movie, but he's there as a, you know, a great character actor.
I mean, there's some interesting stuff that he did, you know, especially with Rutger Hauer, because he modeled his Gotham City as, I forgot the name of the city from Blade Runner.
Okay.
And that's one of the reasons why he cast him.
Interesting.
Dude, at this point, when Batman Begins drops, I had pushed off Batman for a while, and I just reimmersed myself in the lore. I was consuming all of the special features off of the DVD discs, and, you know, I loved the, and I know we talked about this in episode two, specifically about, like, martial arts and our love for that. But I love the fact that we finally got to see a Batman that was, like, versed in multiple styles of martial arts, right? And he is practicing all of those things, and he becomes a freaking ninja. So this movie touched on a whole bunch of things that I loved, and I really thought the psychology of the film and challenging fear was super, super smart and interesting, especially in the selection of its villains with Scarecrow and Ra's al Ghul.
Yeah, it was a bold move. And when
and
I first
Liam
heard
freaking Neeson.
It is. And when I first heard that those were going to be the villains, I was like, you know what? They're onto something here, because, you know, we're not getting, you know, they could have just gone back to the Joker right away or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, doing Ra's al Ghul, it's like, wow, you know, you're actually going to bring that character to life. Like, most people don't even know that character.
Yeah.
And while they did a different take on it, obviously, and they did hold the whole mystery thing around it. You know, I mean, you're right. It's Liam Neeson, and it turns out to be great. shockingly, right?
Yeah.
And the Scarecrow was even really effective. I mean, Scarecrow is one of those villains that could have very easily gone sideways, and they, you know, they did a great job. And Cillian Murphy is a great actor, who, you know, at that point he wasn't incredibly well known, you know, but now he's in Peaky Blinders, which is an amazing show. So he's great as Scarecrow, as Jonathan Crane Scarecrow.
Yeah.
The only thing that stops Batman Begins from being almost perfect to me is the fact that they made the unfortunate decision of not going with Harvey Dent in that movie instead of and going with the Rachel Dawes character, because they felt like they needed a love interest,
right?
And that they didn't have enough time to develop the Harvey Dent story. Katie Holmes is not great in Batman Begins. She's not terrible, right, but she's not great, and that story is not nearly as compelling as it could have been had they done Harvey Dent in that and just do the slow burn and the slow build, especially since they wound up doing the character in Batman in The Dark Knight.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, going to Katie Holmes, best acting in the movie is when she slaps Bruce in the face after he reveals to her that he was going to go in there and shoot, or he was going to shoot Joe Chill. Worst acting is when she gets scared by Batman and hits him with the taser. Ah! Yeah. I swear to God, anybody, go back, watch the movie. It's epically bad. She's like, ah! And then she shoots him with the taser, and but then he kicks it up a notch because he's just like, you stupid ass, why did you? And he just like rips it out of his chest, and he's like, all right, carry on, let's go. I got some work for you to do.
Yeah, and they, you know, but it was really good. I mean, he gave a grounded as you can be with a story like that, and he gave a reason for like why the suit was the suit and why all the weapons were what they were, and you know, that was cool, and he tied it into the whole like R&D thing and Lucius Fox.
Dude, it was really smart.
They did a really great job with that.
It's stuff that exists, and then, you know, they hit The Dark Knight, and you know, for the first time you get a fully functional suit where Batman can turn his head. He's not like sort of positioned with this like panther neck, and you know, the tactile nature of the suit makes a lot of sense.
Yep.
And I mean, he just kicks ass in the suit. I mean, there's so many scenes in that movie where in The Dark Knight where, like, again, my hair stands up, like where he gets where he blows up the side of the building when he's in China and he gets like picked up the air cable thing.
Oh, well,
lose my mind every time I see that.
Dark Knight. I mean, obviously everyone talks about Heath Ledger, and that's just, it's a once in a lifetime tour de force performance of what he does. And unfortunately, obviously, you know, he passed before the movie was even released, which makes it even more tragic. But he's so fantastic in that role that it overshadows what is, you know, overall a really great film. I mean, Aaron Eckhart is great, you know, as Harvey Dent. Yeah. And now they rushed unfortunately, the Two-Face story. It could have been even better had they gone back to Batman Begins and done it there. But still, having said that, he's really good. The, you know, Maggie Gyllenhaal replaces Katie Holmes as Rachel Dawes, which is a little awkward. And I know somebody like you who's a big continuity guy, it's a little weird. But, you know, she's fine. The scene where she meets her demise, which also winds up becoming their version of the Two-Face origin, is good. It's emotional, you know, and it ties into the whole, you know, Joker, just the chaos that he's looking to create.
I mean, that scene where Batman leaves the coin and Harvey picks it up thinking, oh, it's okay, because it's one side, it's clear, it's clean, and then he flips it over and it's been charred, scratched.
Yep.
Man, such a good scene.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, I mean, that movie is an emotional roller coaster. It's very tense. And when we haven't even mentioned Gary Oldman yet, I mean, who's Commissioner Gordon, and they finally did establish that relationship.
Yep.
And add some weight to that relationship. And he's obviously just an amazing actor, another amazing actor in one of these movies. I mean, this trilogy is loaded with talent. It's unbelievable. And it's really a pleasure that it's an honor that they were able to take my favorite character in Batman and just put all of this talent into these movies. You know, so The Dark Knight is, you know, many people consider it the best superhero movie ever made. You know, I'm not going to argue if you think it is, you know, or isn't, whatever. It doesn't really matter. It is what it is. It's an amazing film. It's an all-time great performance. But there are a lot of good performances in that movie. And it's definitely a movie that everybody should watch, you know, obviously, if you're a Batman fan. Although, you know, I still nowadays prefer Batman Begins as an overall movie.
Yeah. I agree with you. I mean, there are certain... you know, I know The Dark Knight sort of intimately, all of the scenes, so I kind of fast forward through things I want to see and watch over and over again, where the acting and the writing is just like that interrogation
scene.
The
interrogation scene is, I don't know that there's very many scenes that are better in any movie.
Yeah. I mean, I would say that is the best scene in a superhero film.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, and then, you know, Heath Ledger's passing, like you mentioned, and I think, you know, this franchise kind of pumped the brakes a little bit. I remember after his death and, you know, people asking Nolan, oh, you know, do you have are you going to be making the third movie? And he was like, I don't know. You know, it depends on if there's a good story to tell. And of course I was excited when they announced that he'd be coming back and then all the key players and actors would be, you know, sort of returning. But it kind of felt from the jump that this wasn't going to be as good as The Dark Knight.
Yeah.
From the onset. Like, and this is, you know, this was just my feeling. I don't know how you felt about it, Chris, but it felt like some of the wind was lost in the sails.
I mean, a little bit. I still... you know, had hopes that it was going to be great because it still was same. Nolan, you know, and it still obviously had, like you said, pretty much everybody back. And we don't know what the plans were going to be for the Joker going forward. You would figure he was going to have a huge role in it.
But, right.
It's just that, you know, a lot of people, Dark Knight Rises is a polarizing movie in that it does elicit very passionate responses on, you know, some people hate it, some people love it, some people don't think it's a Batman movie at all. Some people say you're crazy. They think it's a bold take by actually making a Batman movie that doesn't really have Batman in it very much, but it does... The reason why I give it a pass on that is because I do feel like one of the main themes of Nolan's Batman movies was Batman as a symbol, right?
Yeah.
It's the whole, you know, reason why he chooses to become Batman, you know, because the symbol that was always bigger than the one man.
Right.
So
right.
Dark Knight Rises really drives that theme home.
Yep.
You know,
yep.
Because Batman as a symbol, as an ideal, does become bigger and more powerful and does ultimately become the thing that does save the day and rallies people around. So that's why I didn't mind kind of not having Batman that much in the Batman movie. And I liked the John Blake character. I know a lot of people were like, eh, whatever. I liked that character. I just, where things fell flat with me a little bit on that was... I thought that they opened the movie and kind of already tying into sort of doing the Dark Knight Returns thing where he's like in retirement and like,
he become a hermit. He's
That was sort of out of nowhere for me. Like he wasn't, and I don't think he was really old enough and to really for me to buy that necessarily.
Right.
I know what they were going with. Anne Hathaway, I thought was fine. The character, I don't know. The character itself wasn't great for me, but she was good. I'm, you know, a fan of hers. But overall, yeah, I enjoyed The Dark Knight Rises. It's just not a movie that I find myself going back to watch much.
Yeah, yeah, agreed. I do the same thing, kind of jump around. I liked Bane. I will say I did.
He's fine.
Really,
I mean, you know, it's not the best take on the character, but I know, again, I understand where they were going with and what they were trying to do with it, and it's not a bad take considering, you know, how
than Swollen Grape Man.
It's Swollen Grape Man is a great example of how you can very easily go wrong with a character, and they right. certainly didn't do that. So it's yeah. not a perfect version of Bane, but it's fine. He just had a very high standard to live up to, obviously, following one of the great movie villains of all time. And that was kind of the position that he was in. It was going to be tough. And Tom Hardy's great, and the character was good. You know, I won't argue with people. I liked it. It's just, again, for me, it's a movie that I could skip and have skipped on many an occasion. But, you know, but it was successful.
And it closed out that trilogy.
Yeah, and it closes out the trilogy, and it makes it a full story with a beginning, middle, and end that all thematically works and ties together. So that's really all you can ask for, I think. The next time we see Batman, though, on the big screen, is in Batman v Superman: Dawn of Justice. So now, regardless of what you think of the movie itself, I think many people look at Batman in Batman v Superman the way we look at, like we talked about Obi-Wan in the episode when we were talking with Rick Hsu about Star Wars. You know, whatever people think of the prequel trilogy, they tend to agree that, you know, Ewan McGregor was really good as Obi-Wan. I think most people, whether you loved or hated BVS, most people at least tend to agree that the look of Batman was great. The attitude, the vibe, they really felt like they nailed Batman in that movie. And I guess I fall into that category. I didn't like Batman v Superman, but I did enjoy Batman in Batman v Superman. I had bigger problems with the Superman part.
I mean, there were some liberties taken with the character that I thought were a little exaggerated, and they really pushed the envelope with him. But for the most part, yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think Affleck did a fine job at stepping into the role and sort of owning that. I mean, the warehouse scene, despite its violence and, gratuity, is a great scene. I love it. Actually, I can watch that scene like over and over
again. Yeah, it's great. I mean, he looks
well
great.
Choreographed.
Yeah, and the costume is great. It's you know, ripped right out of the comics. It's kind of a hybrid of like the Frank Miller and the more recent like New 52 runs. It's kind of a hybrid of both. It looks really cool. Affleck looked good, and he's good. He was good as Bruce Wayne in that movie. And I mean, Martha aside, they really did a great job with Batman, which is one of the reasons why that movie even makes me more angry, is the fact that it's like, man, you nailed Batman, and it's that movie. Now, where they didn't nail Batman was in Justice League.
No, they did some egregious stuff to Batman in Justice League. And you know what? I know that there are loads of people out there. Oh, give us the Snyder cut. Yada, da, da, da. There is nothing that Snyder cut, Whedon cut, that could have fixed what they did to Batman. I think they cut his balls off, to be honest with you, if I'm being frank here. He's just not the same character. He goes from this like really aggressive force to this like hokey, I'm too old for this crap kind of guy. And I've said it. I said it after we saw Justice League together.
Yes, you did.
I've said it time and time again, but he is the closest to a George Clooney Batman that we'll ever see.
Yes. And it none of us thought of it at the time. And then when you said it that night, we were all like, wow, dude, you just nailed that. Like, and now we can't not think about that. That's all I think about when I think about the Justice League Batman, and it's a shame. And you know, Affleck doesn't help because he kind of sleepwalks through a lot of what we assume were the reshoots. And it's a mess. I've never been as big a fan of Batman in the Justice League, as Super Friends aside, as I have been as Batman on his own, because I think Batman's strengths as a character play more to his own narrative as opposed to the Justice League effect.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that they had to just completely go and give us like you said, a George Clooney Batman cracking one-liners and being, let's really just drive home the fact that he's just like a guy.
And I mean, that's the thing too, right? Because there are so many different takes on how Batman interacts with his fellow Justice League members, and the spin of making him sort of the leader and the one that pulls everyone together, it can work, right? But Batman traditionally is the one that's like keeping tabs on everyone. So if all of these superpowered individuals go off the rails, he's the one person, the one human being that can stop them all. They've done some really, really great stories and even animated films on that concept. So, you know, again, I don't think that, you know, making him the leader was a poor choice. I just feel like his motivations, and this could also go to you know, Affleck's acting abilities in this film, just were washed out and not really there.
Yeah, and I kind of give them a peck. I mean, Justice League is a mess, and who knows what direction it was heading in and whatever. So I don't get too caught up in it. It's just that movie is what it is. The future is where we really have to look at it. Yeah. And we will do that in, you know, part three of this discussion, where we start to look at some of the other characters and looking more towards the future of DC and film. But that's the interesting thing, is where they go with this character from there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, with all of the back and forth and hoopla surrounding Matt Reeves' Batman story, and, you know, again, Mario's done a great job at sort of helping keep everyone on track with the latest rumors and news coming from his sources there. But, you know, it sounds like we may be on the cusp of potentially getting another rebooted Batman, which I am not opposed to, but you know, time will tell, and we'll see where it goes. But that'll, you know, that's for discussion for our next episode.
Yeah. So for now, you can find me at Real CL Mighty on Twitter,
and you can find me at Starting Sith as well on Twitter.
And the show, of course, is at the Fanboy Garage, and we have some exciting things coming up that we'll be announcing really shortly. So you want to, you know, be on the lookout. You know, if you're following us on Twitter, we'll be hitting you with a couple of announcements over the next couple of weeks that we think are pretty exciting. So we look forward to that.
Yeah, we've got some cool merchandise out there. We do have a couple of t-shirts that are left. If you're interested, please direct or DM us at the Fanboy Garage on Twitter, and we'll be sure to get you a shirt. And stay tuned. Thanks for listening. Adios, folks.